We are going to start today with John Dougherty, co-founder and managing director at Inventus Capital. Inventus has been very active in the India-US corridor for some years, and we invited John today to get to know, you know, what is the evolution of your firm's investment thesis and so forth. So welcome, John. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your firm and where, you know, what is your thesis? You're a co-founder of the firm, so you must have founded the firm with a certain thesis, and how has it evolved over the years that you've been in action in this corridor?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this firm is, I guess, one of my entrepreneurial efforts of my own, but along with my co-founders. You know, it all came out of my mutual experience with Conwal Reckey, who some of you may know is, you know, a very successful entrepreneur here in Silicon Valley, the first Indian to emigrate to the U.S., get venture backing and take the company public as a result. And that was way back in the 80s. He was the first to commercialize TCP IP over Ethernet and had a successful IPO and ultimately merged it with Novell and ran Novell for 5 years and took Novell to India, actually, in the early 90s, one of the first to move significant engineering into India, you know, across border with Silicon Valley. And, you know, he and I got to know each other in industry. I was in the PC business back in the 80s when I came out of Berkeley, and then in the workstation business with Sun and Silicon Graphics through the early to mid 90s. And then I got recruited into venture capital in 97. And by that time, Conwal was also had kind of left his operating career and had become a big, very prolific angel investor. I guess he was a super angel before that was a coined term. He was investing in 5 to 6 or 7 new companies every year, you know, for about 10 years. And he and I invested in a number of companies together, largely in the Indian community. You know, as a result of our work together, most of the entrepreneurs I backed and that I gravitated towards even through the mid, late 90s and into the noughts were of Indian origin. And he and I kind of sat down in 2004 when the dust had settled after the dot-com, and we kind of compared notes and discussed the fact that we'd seen a lot of success with the lean startup model, which was just becoming a coined term at that time. And we, you know, we had invested in nearly 80 companies at that point, and we kind of looked at our track records and realized that most of the wealth for both the entrepreneurs and the investors had come in these companies that hadn't taken huge amounts of capital. And many of them were among the first to, you know, for example, like Nextag, were among the first to start in Silicon Valley, but ultimately build 80, 90% of the staff and the engineering and so forth out of India. And so we thought, gee, you know, here we were in 2004, you could see what was happening in China, and you could see the trajectory that China was on as an emerging, you know, entrepreneurial economy. And Conwal had been extremely engaged with both the Prime Minister at that time, Bajpai, and others in India, you know, in the late 90s, and helping them basically reform the economy, open up venture capital, open up sectors like telecom to, you know, private enterprise, and so he was very engaged and saw that, you know, the entrepreneurial ecosystem was emerging there, and we thought, you know, if we're going to start a new venture firm, it's just like starting a company. We should start it in a sector where we have hopefully an unfair advantage, you know, an access to the entrepreneurs and an information advantage where we understand it better than most. And we decided that a smaller venture capital firm of, you know, $50 or $100 million in size, focused on capital efficient entrepreneurs with the leverage of the emerging Indian opportunity, could be the opportunity to build a new kind of leadership firm in that segment. And so that's what we went out to do. So he and I traveled to India, I guess, you know, probably about a dozen times throughout 2005. We were back and forth, seemed like I was on the plane all the time. And we met hundreds of entrepreneurs, talked to the various venture capitalists that were on the ground at that time, and came to the conclusion that there was still a big opportunity to hopefully build the number one firm that would focus on the Indian community, regardless of where they are, whether in Silicon Valley or India. And we made a conscious choice that we didn't want to have ourselves be the only ones involved and be commuting to India, so we sought out experienced partners on the ground in India. So our co-founder, Samir Kumar, joined us. Conwell had known him for probably about 6 years at that point. He'd been a venture capitalist on the ground in Bangalore for that past 6 years with Acer Tech Ventures, ran all their Indian investments. And we went out, raised the fund, which wasn't easy. You know, it was 2007 when we started. It was 2008 when we finished. And obviously, it was a very tumultuous time in the capital markets and in venture in general. You know, venture hadn't produced returns for quite some time at that point in time. And, you know, a lot of investors were losing faith. But we found some that believed in us, and we were able to get it off the ground. Our first fund was $50 million. We started investing that in 2008. Expanded our team. We, you know, had a fourth partner we brought on, Parag Dole, who again had been one of the first venture capitalists in India. He'd been with ICICI back in 1993, and he'd invested in Indian entrepreneurs across the country for nearly 15 years by the time he joined us. So, you know, we felt like we had the best team. We all had operating backgrounds, and we were very focused on entrepreneurs who were applying technology to basically modernize the economy. There's so many opportunities and inefficiencies, as I'm sure many of you know, in India, but also to build world-class products for business customers out of India or between India and Silicon Valley. So our focus was and continues to be on both consumer consumption in India, but also business consumption both in India and globally. So about half our companies are business software companies with a heavy, an increasingly heavy dose of services inside them. So it's not just technology, but it can be really high-end advanced services that are combined there, and I can give you several examples. And, it, you know, it's ebbed and flowed a bit. Obviously, you know, India's gone through a huge renaissance in entrepreneurial efforts in the last, you know, 2 years. Has, you know, been more than a doubling and a tripling of the amount of capital, the number of companies being started, and frankly, the quality of companies being started. All of those have improved since we started. So it's kind of playing out as we expected. You know, 2008 made it a little bit slower to emerge than we'd hoped for in the beginning, but you know, directionally, we're heading in the direction we expected to head, and we're feeling very optimistic about it. And I think that you know, there's some people are worried about the short-term corrections of valuations of those sorts of things, but those are, in our experience, are the normal cycle, and you know, unavoidable in venture in any economy, whether it's China, whether it's Silicon Valley, they always go through these cycles. But I think the underlying fundamentals are still very encouraging. So that's we're very focused on. Yeah.
Let's double click down on some of the things you've said. Yeah. Firstly, our audience is early stage entrepreneurs, and like right. You said, we also believe in this capital efficient entrepreneurship philosophy. We have tried to coach and mentor our entrepreneurs to focus on that philosophy. Having said that, the last, you know, few years, last couple of years especially, have been a bubble market. So in our portfolio, one of the companies has raised $100 million, and, you know, we'll see how that all pans out. So far, so good. They're, you know, doing great, making tons of, you know, getting lots of customers and so forth. So that's all very well. But in general, though, personally, I much prefer companies that don't raise that kind of money and, you know, operate with much leaner, tighter principles. So it sounds like that's where your sweet spot is. So tell us a little bit about where, at what point, from a stage point of view, at what point do you like to invest? What do you like to see as proof point? If you're doing B2C, what do you like to see in terms of traction and validation? If you're doing B2B, what do you like to see so that our entrepreneurs get a feel for when is a good time to start working with you?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And we do have some companies that have raised $100 million or more. We don't have total control over that. And some companies you know, justify it and can put it to good use. So there are exceptions, but the rule is what you outlined, which is capital efficiency, and we find that to be as much in the entrepreneur's interest as ours. But, you know, going to your question of where we focus, we have always been the kind of post-seed Series A investor. Before we started Inventus and ever since we did start Inventus, you know, our sweet spot, you know, while there's always, again, exceptions to any rule, our sweet spot is that lead investor at the Series A stage, which in India and, frankly, in the Indian community in Silicon Valley as well, is generally a company that has a product. Maybe it's just a beta product. But it's usually a product that's working, it's in the hands of customers, and so there's some validation that the product works and that it delivers an ROI that a customer is worth, willing to pay for. So it doesn't need to be huge scale. It's not about how many dollars of revenue. It's about how many customers, how much approbation of the value statement in the business plan is present. And then we would lead the first, $2 to $4 million is typically the general, the general range of the size of the Series A round. We would do, anywhere from half of that to two-thirds of that, and we generally like to syndicate. We think that, again, it's in our best interest, but also I think in the company's best interest to have a good foundation of support at that stage. And so we like to have two firms that are with high conviction, willing to put in, at least $1 million or $2 each to support the company, and hopefully support the future rounds of the company as it progresses. So that's our style. We found, again, this all came out of our own kind of analysis of what had worked and what hadn't in the past, and we found that where we were making highly convicted bets and, significantly engaged with the teams, that we had wonderful results. We've had over a dozen IPOs, dozens of M&A events, over $30 billion in value created from those type of investments, and the areas where we followed other people kind of passively, put in a little money here or there, we kind of broke even, and those companies did okay, but they didn't do great. So no surprise when we formed Inventus, we said, hey, we want to be the lead investor. We don't want to make dozens of investments a year. We want to make six or eight and be highly engaged and very focused. This is just what we coach our entrepreneurs to do, be focused, have high conviction, and so we kind of take our own medicine there.
Let's do a couple of case studies of the kinds of companies that you have invested in, stayed with, and had successes with. And if you could, for the benefit of our entrepreneurs, if you could walk us through the logic and the thought process of what was the investment thesis when you invested, how did it pan out, what did you learn from that, and what can we learn from that?
Sure, sure. Well, I noticed we have a lot of the audiences from India, so I guess I'll start with, we invest in both companies that are based in India as well as those that are headquartered in Silicon Valley, and I can give examples of both. But I guess I'll start with one that was based out of Bangalore. And it's a very typical example of how we work. This is an entrepreneur that actually we started tracking and mentoring, just because we liked him, and he was involved with Thai in Bangalore back in 2006. This is when we were just forming the firm. We didn't have the capital yet, but we were engaged with the community, and we helped him find his seed financing at that time because he was 26-year-old, and he was starting a company called Redbus. And Redbus came out of his own experience trying to get home for the holidays for Diwali, and he couldn't get there because, the state of the art then for bus travel, which is typically how people get to many cities that aren't served by air or they can't afford it, right, was to go down to the bus depot, stand in line, and hope to find a ticket. And that's what he did. He expected he'd get a ticket. By the time he got to the window, that bus route was sold out, and he couldn't get home. And he was very frustrated by that. That was back in 2004 and 2005. And so he started Redbus to do something that sounds very simple but actually was very ambitious, which was to put all these bus operators online, put all the inventory in an online form, similar to Make My Trip for air travel or hotels, so that you could discover and book online rather than having to go physically down to the bus depot. Really ambitious because, like so many things in India, a highly, highly fragmented supply. Not like there's a Greyhound that has 60% market share. We had 1,200 bus operators, and we still do today, none of whom have huge market share. So you have to get hundreds of these bus operators online before you have meaningful inventory. And without meaningful inventory, building a marketplace, consumers don't care. So he had to break that cycle and get meaningful inventory, get the consumers to care. And the innovative thing he did is he built the software that would basically automate the operations for these bus operators, and he gave it to them for free. All the other competitors were trying to charge him for it on a SaaS basis, you know, software as a service basis. He realized, hey, if I can help them move from paper and pencil in a physical register, which is really what it was, you know, what state of the art was, to, you know, automated billing, exposing their inventory to all the other travel agents, the physical travel agents around the country, all for free, then they'll come on my system, they'll expose their inventory in mass, and then consumers will care, and then I'll get my fair share of the ticket sales through my site. And that's exactly how it worked out. We had mentored him for, and you know, tracked him for 18 months, and then in 2008, late 2008, he was looking for his Series A. He had about 2 million in ticket sales trailing, so he's been selling a good number of tickets, but he had, you know, he's owning kind of in the Bangalore region, and you know, we led the Series A. We syndicated it, brought in another, you know, investor. And it was off to the races. He grew 10x in 4 years to over 100 million of ticket sales 4 years later. He raised a total of $9 million. He'd only used four of it. So when he was acquired, which was not something we looked for, we were looking to do an expansion financing, and the strategic investor decided they wanted to buy all the stock instead of some of it. And they gave us a valuation that the entrepreneur was very excited about. And it was a tough decision, but we decided to sell the company. It was a great outcome for him. It was a great outcome for everybody. But again, a very capital efficient business where he owned a lot in the end. And so that's what made the acquisition so attractive for him and for the rest of us.
So I met Funny. This, by the way, the entrepreneur's name in Redbus is Funindra Sama. Funny, he goes by. Mm-hmm. I met him back in 2010, and we did a huge story on him. First in 2011, he's covered the company all along, and he's a great guy, really wonderful person, not just a great entrepreneur. And I think there's a lot. Redbus was one of the first companies in the e-commerce model that actually scaled to a large extent. I guess the question that I have out of all of these Flipkart, Redbus, and all of the e-commerce sector bets is that obviously we're seeing an e-commerce sector bubble in India. Too much money has gone into the sector, and the sector adoption is not as fast. How do you read? Obviously, you made the Redbus investment in 2008. Now we are in 2016. What is your analysis of the B2C e-commerce sector in India?
That's a good question, and I think that there are, like any sector, there are attractive companies and there are challenging companies. I think that our thesis back then, you know, we looked at some of these other kind of horizontal e-commerce players that you've mentioned. They were taking inventory. We didn't like that. And they're subsidizing, and we're not in favor of that. It doesn't mean it can't work. Don't get me wrong, but for our fund size and for our strategy, it just didn't meet the filter that we have and that we stuck to, which is, hey, we want to see companies like Redbus that are enabling people to do something they otherwise couldn't and who are willing to pay for it. And so if you look at the Redbus story, for example, in e-commerce, they were charging – about 8% commission to the bus operator for the seats they were filling when we first invested. By the time we sold the company, they were charging almost 11%. They had increased pricing, and everybody was very happy, including the bus operator, because the bus operator was getting more and more seats filled that otherwise would go vacant. So every incremental seat that they filled for that bus company was pure profit. to that bus company. And so it was a very, very accretive model that everybody in the ecosystem, you know, enjoyed a benefit from. And that's what we're fundamentally looking for. And I think that in e-commerce, you know, so we for example, have then therefore had a thesis around services-based businesses in e-commerce for consumer. You know, financial technologies are a big segment there, right? So there's not a physical good that I'm handling at a high cost that has a shelf life that may, you know, spoil and have obsolescence or returns or all these other things. So whether it's insurance, so we invested in Policy Bazaar, which is the leading online insurance marketplace by a factor of 10 over its competition now. It was about the factor of 5 when we first invested. Just accelerating away as it's gaining share and, again, you know, getting increasing commissions from the insurance providers for selling through to the consumer in India. We're the lead investor in Funds India, which is the leading online mutual fund marketplace for consumers in India. It's just dramatically growing. And again, providing price discovery, understanding of these products so that you can stay away from the products with the high fees, the high loads, or in insurance where you cannot, you know, be taken advantage of with, you know, basically being sold annuities that never pay off compared to the premiums that are demanded. So there's a consumer benefit there. There's a benefit to the insurance agency as they have broader reach to the consumer, and there's a benefit to us and everybody shares in it. And so we look for those dynamics, and I think those dynamics are very present in the market today, but I think the headlines are going to the kind of horizontal players that have kind of, you know, taken the quote-unquote Amazon bet, you know, where Amazon, for example, in the United States had to basically subsidize its business for over a decade before it could establish dominance and pricing power. And that is where capital is a weapon. It's very capital intensive, and the last person to get the capital is going to win. Those are fine for large funds and, you know, funds that want to, you know, participate in that.
You can't blame that.
That's not what we want to do. It's not what we built our firm to do. But
it's also a very risky game to play for entrepreneurs, because at some point the capital may dry out and then you're left to holding the bucket, basically. We see a ton of companies in Silicon Valley also kind of running out of runway.
Yeah, I think that it's very interesting. The cycle here is very similar. You know, for the last 10 years we've been doing this, right? And it was kind of counter-cyclical. Silicon Valley's up and India was down, or India's up and Silicon Valley's going through a correction. The cycles were offset. But I think in this last, right now, and in this last 18 months, they've been, you know, in parallel. They're both going through the same kind of valuation correction and burn rate correction. I think it's very different than it was, you know, Conwell and I and Parag, you know, we all lived through the dot-com. And I would tell you that we don't think this is like that. You know, back then, the fundamental problem was more about like the tulip craze, right? There was no fundamental market of scale to justify what had happened. Here, I think that's quite different. I mean, the markets are clearly available at scale. You know, the Flipkarts, the Snap deals, even our own companies, they're selling billions of dollars of goods and services. Consumers are spending at scale through these sites for these businesses. The question is, how do you value them? How do you build a business model around them that can be sustainable and have attractive profitability in our lifetime? Those are the fundamental issues that have kind of gotten out of whack that are going through a correction here. But I do think that someone's going to win. These are winner-take-most markets, as they usually are. Someone's going to win. There might be two that actually, you know, establish an oligopoly and maybe segment, you know, into different product categories or regions.
Amazon itself is a player. Amazon is not going away. Amazon is going to be a major player. So this is not a market
That's right. They may be the one to win. They may be the one to win. They're certainly in the horse race, and you know, all the anecdotes you hear is that they're nudging ahead currently. We'll see how, you know, So there's always growth pains for any company, even the established ones, when they go into these new markets. So I don't know who's going to win, but I think someone will. And so I don't think it'll be like the dot-com where nobody won. You know, there's very, very few companies that survived.
Well, the dot-com also people won. You know, there were perhaps less visible companies. Well, first and foremost, Amazon won out of the dot-com. And then there were companies like Blue Nile that built very substantial companies, founded in 1999, built a $300, $400 million business over the, you know, duration of their the last 10 years or last 7 years.
I'm just saying, I don't think that back then there was just, you can count on one hand or a couple of hands the big winners, right? Because so many didn't make it. I don't think it'll be as difficult a winnowing this time, is what I'm trying to say. I think there's enough fundamental
The volume of the throughput is going to be much higher this time around, absolutely. So switching gears a little bit, on the B2B side, there are, you know, we've talked to a number of, we work with a number of investors, especially investors like yourself who are small funds. By the way, we have an investment, we have a portfolio company that Parag founded, funded, called Avaaz out of India.
Yeah.
It's,
very
I introduced Ajit to Parag some years back, and it's a really very, very good entrepreneur. It's a very tricky segment, but it's a very good entrepreneur. But coming back to B2B, you know, the trend that we are seeing is twofold. The VCs are kind of shying away from B2B SaaS or B2B technology that is facing the Indian market and moving more towards the global market. So if you're doing a B2B SaaS company, for example, then you are fundable if you work on the global opportunity. You're not fundable if you're working on the India-facing opportunity, is kind of the buzz that's you know, percolating into the ecosystem. What is your fund's perspective on this?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very practical issue of market size, and not just, market size someday, but
adoption.
Well, that's true, but, you know, it's market size and market access, and we take a very specific view company by company, so we don't have a kind of a whitewash answer on this. It's not an either or. It's not either India or global. It's a bit of both. You know, we look at these companies kind of fundamentally bottoms up. And, for example, we've got a company, Power to SME, that is building a business-to-business marketplace that, for India alone, only India, that is just on fire. It's scaling dramatically, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, thousands and thousands of crores of product moving through this company. And it's all in India, and it's all businesses buying from businesses. And so there's an example of where B2B works in India. And we have a fundamental view that's emerging. Huh?
What is the name of the company?
Power to SME. So, you know, they're providing a buying club to basically help small, medium enterprises in India access better pricing for the fundamental raw materials of their businesses, whether it's polymers or steel or cement, where they have to go and get, you know, just a terrible price per ton at a wholesaler, or, you know, try and go direct and get no respect from the manufacturers because they're just so small, right? But if they gang together through this digital marketplace aggregate their orders, you know, magic is happening. And so fundamentally our research there was, hey, the existing size of that market in India only is over $100 billion. $100 billion of cement and steel and polymers, all these different things that could be more efficient with the benefit of this company's technology. And that's a big enough market for a venture-backed startup, right? And they have price. They're getting a good gross margin. They're not having to subsidize. And, in fact, their margins are going up because, again, it's a virtual cycle. Everybody's enjoying a benefit, and so they're getting an increasing share of that benefit as they scale. But I think that the point about SaaS is all about market size. We have a different view. Most of the SaaS companies, and we've been doing SaaS companies since we started 10 years ago out of India, we've always had a thesis that business software companies were going to be very interesting product opportunities. And that came out of our own perspective of, hey, we don't have a geographic bias. We're going to invest in startups in Silicon Valley. We're going to invest in startups in India. And we do it out of a thesis-based approach. And we say, which one is the best product? Because these are global markets. And even business software that's addressing the Indian market ultimately is going to face competition from overseas, or they're going to have to go overseas. So they have to be able to be, you have to have a thesis that they can be number one. And so, for example, in MarTech, marketing technology, you know, we made several investments in companies that were going after the Indian market at the time that we made the Series A investment. And didn't have any overseas operation. They kind of thought maybe someday they'd go overseas, but they're going after the Indian market, and we backed those entrepreneurs, and we're very pleased. I mean, they've now, you know, scaled dramatically. They have gone outside India ultimately, but they've done it with a huge advantage of having a really well-perfected product as a result of serving the Indian business customer. Okay. And so that Indian business customer actually is oftentimes more demanding, more difficult to service than a U.S. or a Chinese or, you know, a Southeast Asian customer.
Well, it's
customer.
Good to validate in the local market and get your product right and then go after the global opportunity. But I think you're kind of reinforcing what we are seeing in terms of trends is that the Indian market is a slow growth market. The Indian SME market in particular and the enterprise market also, these are slow growth markets and slow adoption curve markets. So eventually, to get fast growth, people have to, with the marketplace example that you gave is different when it comes to selling software or IT, if those have not been the fastest growing market. We've done a few stories that are.
That's true. Yeah, Sharma, you're right. I mean, in the rearview mirror, steering the ship in the rearview mirror, that's absolutely the case. I guess that we still believe, and we're beginning to see the glimmer of it, that, you know, Indian business, Indian industry will value technology over labor. And that's the key.
They have to.
So looking for that, we're optimistic about that. And I think that some of that change is afoot. We're starting to see that some of these businesses are adopting software rather than just hiring a dozen more people to do it manually.
I think in both the case of e-commerce and in the case of technology adoption by the B2B world, the enterprises and the SMEs in India, the trends are in the right direction. Those markets are going to accelerate. They have been slower for the last, you know, decade, but they're accelerating and they will continue to accelerate. So there will come a point where it will become a lot more, you know, viable to build Indian market-facing businesses even on the B2B side. So one last question before we switch to the mentoring part. You said that you invest both in Silicon Valley and in India. And you started by saying you invest mostly in the Indian community. Now, our community is not just Indian. We have tons of, you know, members from all over the world, all ethnicities and so forth. So do you only invest in the Indian entrepreneurs or do you invest in other ethnicities as well?
Yeah, thank you for asking that because that's an important clarification. We have what we believe is a preferential and a very kind of mature deal network in the Indian community, and therefore, a lot of our deal flow comes from that community. But we don't have that bias. So we've backed, you know, Iranian entrepreneurs. We've backed, you know, just plain old American entrepreneurs. You know, our agreement with our investors is that we're going to expose them predominantly to an Indian opportunity, but not exclusively. And so, no, we don't have a bias to say that we have our, you know, our eyes closed and our blinders on to anything but something with an Indian founder. You know, the reality is that we think you know, we just find so many compelling business reasons. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. There's so many compelling business reasons. For example, we've got this company, Resilinc, that's here in Silicon Valley, that's selling to General Motors and Delphi, you know, multi-year large contracts for business software to manage their supply chains, and they just have a fundamental cost and business service advantage because they're doing it all out of Pune. So they've got 90% mm-hmm. of the company in Pune. They've got the front end sales and marketing and some architecture here in Silicon Valley, and they are just running circles around their Silicon Valley competitors because they have a fundamentally lower cost of doing business and really, really deep technology built by, you know, a staff of over 100 engineers out of India. And you just couldn't do this company in Silicon Valley with any kind of capital efficiency today, but they can.
Right.
And so, again, here's a company that's taken less than $10 million in total in venture capital, and it's scaling dramatically because of that, and it's beating its competition. So that's what we look for, and whether it's, you know.
So the bottom line is you're looking for capital efficiency. How entrepreneurs achieve that is up to them,
right.
And definitely using Indian engineering development centers
is one of the
ways that people are doing it. Absolutely.
Other companies we've got, they've got teams in Russia, right? We've got teams with, you know, some really core engineering and big data talent and data scientists out of Russia. But I think that the message for us and for anybody that is listening is that, you know, we are early stage investors, and we fundamentally believe that we need to be near our entrepreneurs and our teams, and you know, physically close to our founding teams. And so, you know, that means Silicon Valley in India, in California, and maybe some other parts of the U.S. But we don't tend to think about Europe. You know, if people are domiciled elsewhere, it's just not for us, not the right choice for that company.